Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Peter Fortunato. Fortunato is a graduate of both Cornell University and the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He has taught writing and literature at Cornell Summer College and at Ithaca College, and has published several collections of poetry, including his most recent, entitled Late Morning, New and Selected Poems. It was published by Cuga Lake Books in the spring of 2013. He is the recipient of many awards, including the Emily Dickinson Prize of the Poetry Society of America. And welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Tish. I've been listening to the show for years.
Great. Now, I like to begin by having my guests tell me how they got into their art and their craft. And so what got you into poetry?
Well, I think that I was always interested in language because I grew up bicultural in an Italian-American family and bilingual. So we always spoke Italian at home. In fact, we spoke a couple of different Italian dialects when my grandparents were still living with us. So there was a special attention to language, and often my father or my grandparents would say, how do you say that in Italian, or how do you say that in English? They wanted me to have the Italian as well, and I was often translating the English for them into Italian.
Ah, so you had to learn how to be concise, which, you know, poetry is such a concise language.
Yes, and pay attention to words, really, very carefully. And, you know, to learning vocabularies both in English and Italian.
Wow.
I really think that was the beginning of it.
Uh-huh. Well, that makes total sense to me. Now, you talk about your love of the natural world being honed when you were living in California. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know if my love of the natural world was honed in California. I was always a country boy. And, in fact, I came to Ithaca because I thought I was going to be a veterinarian and actually be a horse doctor because
wow.
I love horses. Grew up in the country, so I was always in the woods. In California, I lived in what's called the backcountry. Nowadays, everybody talks about living off the grid. But I lived without electricity or running water in North San Juan, which is a little town in the foothills of the northern Sierra Nevada.
Uh-huh.
And it was at that time that my wife, the poet Mary Gilliland, and I were the poetry apprentices of Gary Snyder. He had invited us to come out there, live with him, practice Zen Buddhism in his household, and also learn carpentry with some friends of his in the backcountry. Everybody was building in those days.
Wow, what an interesting story. So did you actually get turned on to poetry by him, or had you already started that road?
No. In fact, I had sent him poems over the years because I loved his work so much. And that's another thing I'm indebted to my wife for. She really turned me on to Gary. I had long been a fan of Allen Ginsberg, a close friend and associate of Gary Snyder.
Mm-hmm.
But Mary turned me on to Gary Snyder, and I met him several times over the years and would always send him poems. And he would write back to me about my poems, encouraging me. And then on one fateful evening here in Ithaca, New York, after he read at Cornell, Mary and I went to a party for him afterwards, and we really hit it off. And he said, you know what, how'd you like to come out to California and be part of this backcountry community?
Wow, how interesting.
Yeah.
God, what an interesting way to get really immersed into poetry.
Yes, right. And if you think about it, I mean, that's often been a traditional with all the arts, is you find someone who is your model, or, you know, someone you'd like to emulate.
Who can mentor, yeah.
Maybe they do mentor mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you can have an apprenticeship without ever having met the poet as
mm-hmm.
well. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you have many favorite poets who've been so important who are beyond this lifetime, right?
Absolutely.
We all do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The influence is infinite. Now, I want to have you read from your collection, Late Morning.
Yeah.
Before you do, can you tell me why, at this point in your life, you decided to put a selected works together?
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, I think the title has some resonance with that. I'm not terribly young in years anymore, but I still feel that I every day is a new morning. So the title has that possible interpretation. It's a little later in my life, but I also wanted to be sure that poems from my two early collections, A Bell or a Hook and Letters to T.O. Hero, did not simply disappear. In fact, those books are both available on Amazon, and I've done searches for them, and there are people even selling them for some rather high prices. They're collector's editions.
Oh, that's
but
great.
I thought at this point in my life, I wanted to select my very favorites from those early books and a couple of other book-length manuscripts that I had not had published. I had published a lot of the individual poems, mm-hmm. but I wanted to select them. And then I had some very new things that I thought would top off this particular book.
So that makes sense to me. Well, let's start out with you reading from Late Morning, and this one's called For the Seed.
Yes. For the seed. Only as the passage of rain, it is known partly in rain falling on cold quince and hawthorn, apple and pear. Fruit fallen lies open, overripe, when October passes, green again into the night. I know the whole motion of this moment. Feeling, having heard the drip from house eaves onto an overturned metal pail sounding rain. All the world is falling, whole, and opens for the seed.
I love it. I want to ask you about your Buddhism. You've been a practicing Buddhist for a long time. How much does that inform your work? Because this seemed like kind of a Buddhist poem. That's why I picked it.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the values in Buddhism, let's put it that way, is the suchness of the world, right? In fact, a Buddha, a Tathagata, that's a Sanskrit word, is regarded as one who is thus come. So the suchness or the thusness of the world in all its aspects, and imagistically, that's where the Buddhist echo might be in a poem like this. Of course, that's a lot of the aesthetic from Japanese and Chinese poetry, which have both been very important to me in translation primarily.
Uh-huh. And do you think some of your love of Buddhism has to do with nature and words? And, you know, I mean, almost all poets I've ever met have been looking for the essence or the center of things.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I mean, in Buddhism, we talk about our real nature, right? And sometimes we call that our Buddha nature. So the nature of mind itself, it is something natural. It's unfabricated and uncontrived. And a Buddhist tries to live in accord with that. I mean, that is the way of ease itself. That is the Tao, as it's sometimes referred to in Chinese. So to use words or any other media, one tries to be in harmony with that principle. That principle is ineffable, right? There is nothing you can really point to and grab hold of and say, this is Buddha, this is Buddha nature, this is the Tao. But words or whatever the media can evoke it, they can point to it. And I try to use language and diction that's fairly simple so that people can get a feeling for it.
Yeah. In some ways, emotions can be simple. We've made them complicated in many ways.
Yeah. In fact, in Buddhist practice, I mean, certainly one is not trying to cancel emotion or cancel thoughts in meditation. Far from it. You're trying to witness and observe things just as they are. So when emotions arise, you witness them. Yeah. Of course, you notice they're quite impermanent.
Yeah, absolutely. I have read that you're a ceremony maker. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that.
Yes, well, I practice shamanism, and for a long time I have done ceremonies in public with people. Sometimes it looks a little more like performance art, and often I've collaborated with the musicians and dancers and done spoken word that is ceremonial. It might be, for example, at the winter solstice. We just had a winter solstice, December 21st. I also am ordained as a minister in the Universal Life Church, which is a wonderful organization, so that I've performed many weddings. I've done memorial services for deceased people. And in many respects, if I'm practicing shamanism publicly or functioning as a kind of priest in a public situation, I'm trying to align people with larger powers, making ceremony appropriate to the circumstance.
And do your ceremonies always include poetry?
Well, I can't get away from the power of words, right?
Absolutely.
It's one of my gifts, so I like to share that.
What about the fact that you're a visual artist? Because to me, poetry is a visual art, too.
Yeah.
So what else do you do? Do you paint?
Yes. I paint and draw. I just had a show, in fact, in the month of December at Sarah's Patisserie downtown. And this year has been a very big year for me as a visual artist. I've had two solo shows. It was always a parallel track with the interest in language and also in the interest in performance, so that I never let go of that. And about 6 years ago, indeed, it was when I was living in Qatar, when I was working over there, I was alone a lot of the time. And so I had a huge apartment with a huge dining room table. I started buying art supplies and making art very seriously.
Yeah. A man of many expressions. let's have you read another poem from Late Morning. This one's called What Passed Over.
Yes. What Passed Over. Two nights, three, a slip of a moon, the newborn babe, eagerly growing, rocked in the treetops, sleeps with the sun. Clouds over valley, hidden hills. Days, the heat builds, storms down the lake, settles into you. Is the body real? It feels thick. Then the fever breaks, squalling, cools. And fuller, curving away, the moon spins to the vanishing point. Where does the sun set in July? Pink light on the backs of your hands under fresh cumulus clouds. Cold Canada air trailing through.
Well, that's a very visual poem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is the body real? I love that line.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about where that poem came from?
Sure.
It seems very interesting and complicated.
Yeah, I can be very precise about that. At the time, I was living out in the town of Enfield, out on West Hill. And so driving into Ithaca, we'd be driving down Haights Road toward the lake. And, of course, we saw a lot of the cloudscapes over the lake and heat waves and thunderstorms coming. Mm-hmm. And I remember very particularly this July, there had been an incredible heat wave, very humid, and we were all waiting for it to break. And the feeling feverish with the heat, you know, and then suddenly there's a change. Cold Canada air trailing through.
Yeah, I have to go back to that. Is the body real? That really resonated with me because it really isn't in some ways. You know what I mean? I mean, you absolutely know what I mean.
Yeah, that's Buddhism. That's an awareness of the impermanence of things. I mean, it seems real, but we know it's passing also.
Yeah. If only we could feel it that way instead of the heaviness that you describe in the poem. Tell us a little bit more about living in the Gulf region.
Oh, yeah.
I find that very fascinating. How did that affect your writing?
Yeah. Well, it affected it in that it caused me to be very introspective. So I was teaching writing at Weill Cornell Medical College, right? The Weill Cornell Medical College has a branch campus in Qatar at the invitation of the Qataris. And the pre-medical program includes two writing seminars. The courses are the same as they would be here at Cornell Ithaca. So I was very animated with regard to trying to bring a sense of the American educational system there and trying to help my students, who were from all over the world, incidentally, not only from the Persian Gulf and from the Arab world, but trying to bring them a sense of what we do well in America and what I still believe in America. Freedom of expression, openness of mind, liberal attitudes about the body, about people's differences, the inclusiveness, the great tolerance that are our ideals in the United States.
Yeah.
So I was very aware of myself as an American in the public dimension of my life, but I was also alone a lot of the time. And I felt a great freedom, actually, to write because I was so far from home and to try many different kinds of things.
Did you teach in English? Was it all
yes,
in English?
Yes. Ah. And, you know, this is to the students' credit. Many of them were not native speakers of English, had acquired it even sometimes later in life. But the entire curriculum is in English.
Hmm. I would be afraid to get into politics in the Middle East. Did you get questioned about American policy and
well,
so on?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, actually, one of the reasons I went there, it was the Iraq War was still going on. It was during Bush's second term.
Hmm.
And I was quite unhappy about the nature of the Iraq War and American foreign policy. And I didn't know how I would be received as an American. As I just said, I was trying to represent those things that I think are great about America.
Yeah. And the ideals, too.
The ideals,
yeah.
And people were able to differentiate. And really, that was a wonderful, eye-opening experience. They were able to differentiate between the war and certain aspects of American foreign policy and what is wonderful about America and about Americans, including myself. I was warmly accepted, especially in Qatar.
When I have traveled, and it's been a worry because I've often traveled when we've been involved in wars and controversial policy and so on. So it is interesting how one usually gets it's well received.
Yeah, and I think here
because of the ideals, I think.
Well, in fact, and anybody who's ever been to the United States sees what we have at our best. I think Americans who don't travel abroad are often ignorant of how we are perceived and how other people are able to differentiate between our foreign policies, our public mistakes, as it were, and who we are as American people.
Yeah. I want to have you read another from Late Morning, and this is a political poem, after Grenada, a week of Marines in the news.
Yeah. So I was reviewing this in my memory. I remember this poem was published, I think, in the Ithaca Times. Maybe back then it was called the New Times or even the Times Monitor. This was during the Reagan administration.
Mm.
And just to refresh listeners' memories, when Reagan was elected in 1980, this was the beginning of the remilitarization of the United States and United States foreign policy. Grenada is a tiny island in the Caribbean, and there actually was an outpost of a medical school there, and there were a number of American citizens who were med students there. Now, this was the premise for the invasion of Grenada, because the United States felt that there was going to be a political revolution there, and the people coming to power might not be favorable to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, we had to storm in, rescue the American medical students, repatriate them, and in a sense, overthrow the rebellious government.
I remember this.
I'm not sure what's happening since then. But if you remember it, this was also a great rehearsal for the invasion of Panama and also a great rehearsal for the beginning of a rather aggressive United States foreign policy in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
We were building up our military again after the Vietnam War era, when some of us were hopeful that maybe we could be a little less militant. But suddenly it was the Marines every day, a week of the Marines every day over this particular incident. So that's what the poem is about. After Grenada, as Americans would pronounce it, after Grenada, and a week of Marines in the news. Let the dying grass hunch its shoulders back on winter's coming in the leaf shower. In the gale light, the shifting homilies of the governors of the new political climate. Members of the Congress, the burnt blades demand to be counted, and the ash tree has waved all her flags for the children. Will you be deaf all winter? It's none of my business what the officials have before breakfast, but I awoke troubled and strange to myself. My coffee spoke loudly, and still in bed, I argued with my wife. A heavy squall line raced through the sky. The day opened along a strand of light that had encircled the planet while I slept. This gave me hope. I took my first tentative steps. I burned old newspapers and useless magazines and many favorite pieces of hardwood sawn just yesterday. And so, I thought, my wealth, my life are accountable, too, in the passing blaze.
Yeah. You know, I've asked a lot of poets whether they think politics should come into the art. And a lot of them say no. Did you have anything to expound on that? I mean, you obviously are writing political poems.
Yeah. When it's natural, I think, when it's called for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think that it's one job, perhaps, of a poet is in some way to record the passing political moment. It's a matter of history.
I agree.
You know, and as you probably know, political poems become dated very quickly and people lose track. People might not know about Grenada if we hadn't refreshed their memory.
Yeah.
But it's important for somebody to remember and take note of it. So, if it comes in naturally, certainly.
Yeah, and instead of just a propaganda piece.
Yeah.
That's what other people have said, too. Now, I've also talked to a lot of poets about the mystery of where poems come from. Do you feel like they come from the blue, or do you work hard to try to excavate you know, how you're feeling. How do you work?
Well, I think the revising always is the hard work, right? The fun is in the first draft, mm-hmm. you know, when you're letting it rip. And you really, if you're in it, you know, if you're in the flow, there's a rhythm that you're excited. You see pictures, you know, you have strong emotions. Everything seems connected to your creative moment. That's really the fun of being an artist. And the sweat comes afterwards when you have to start weeding through and pruning out and getting it just right and trying to be sure, did I really hear it that way? Is the poem asking for something other than what I thought at first? Mm. And so that's a different level of engagement with it.
Yeah, but do you think it's kind of a mysterious language sort of comes to us from...
Yeah, and I mean, and if there's no mystery, it very quickly becomes prosaic and expository rather than lyrical and evocative.
Uh-huh. What do you feel about performing poetry? Mm-hmm. I mean, you obviously ceremony is part of your life, and that includes poetry. Do you feel like people should read in kind of a neutral way so that the listener can decide? Or do you like to be dramatic and, you know, sort of... make sure they understand where you're coming from, you know, sad, happy.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Well, I, for me, as the reader of my own poems, I mean, I'm reading them the way I hear them, and I'm trying to render them in that fashion. So as many other writers of free verse especially have said, the poem on the page is something like a musical score. And you're trying to write it typographically so that somebody else reading it has a sense of the music, including the rhythm and perhaps rhyme and certain intonations. Then again, other people may read it differently than the author herself, you know, and other people might prefer to read silently. For some people, reading poetry is very much a private affair. It's between their eyes and the printed words on the page, and what that does inside of them, within their imaginations. Yeah. So again, the analogy holds, I think. Different musicians might interpret a piece of music very differently from one another.
I met someone who's actually an editor of a magazine, a literary magazine, and she said, the poems don't really come alive till I hear the poet read them, which to me is really interesting. And I feel that way, too.
Yes, I agree with you. And I always want to hear a poet read her own work, and then I'll have a new sense of who she is as a writer and what the poem itself is about. I agree with that. I like that.
Did you in your teaching find that you need to teach people how to read poetry? I mean, not everybody does, and they can ruin a poem.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I'm often delighted, you know, when you ask a classroom of college students, or really any students, you know, would somebody like to read the poem aloud? Which hands go up? And very often, it's the person who really has enjoyed it aloud, you know, and who wants to have the moment to perform for the class and render the poem, embody the poem vocally,
manipulate the audience in some ways.
In some way, maybe that is why people become performers.
Yeah,
they want something from the audience as well as wanting to give something.
Yeah, I think mainly it's an emotional connection that people are looking for, no matter what we're doing in front of each other.
Yes, yes.
You know.
Well, I think performance is very erotic. If you take my point in the broadest possible way, there is an exchange of energy. That is the energy of life. That is the give and take of life energy.
Yeah. Before we went out of time, I do want you to read another poem from Late Morning. You said this was a newer poem. This is called Say This.
Yeah. Yeah, Say This is the concluding poem in the book. But I like to remind readers, if you read the very first poem in the book, One Step, Two Step, this poem really nicely completes the cycle of all the work in Late Morning. Say this. Say this is all illusion, as say Indian sages who have put it so thousands of years since the Indus Valley, where on a tiny tablet, seated cross-legged, is found the image of a horned yogin, perhaps Pashupati himself, lord of animals. Lately, having lights in my eyes glitter so substantially as to render insubstantial all photogenic forms, I see my own believing in their presence as exactly that, my self-delusion, one to which, albeit I am well accustomed, as are we all, since when, having been told, that is not what you are, yet that could be what you own, if you bow down to me. As Satan is said to have said to Jesus in a desert way to the west of what is now called Pakistan, Nation states are, of course, illusions. Borders roped with blood, where warriors are pressed to serve because their fathers did, with lords who claim they were descended from the sky. Men are such tools of the wind and stones. Instead of the radio news, rather than lament, I laugh and remember my horns. My legs folded under me in meditation, watching my own mind as the game emerges from a thorny thicket and looks back at me, wise as a goat, an antlered stag.
I love that. I love that poem. The first thing I thought was, he's gone back to the beginning of things.
Yeah.
But he had to travel along these wars and these artificial borders. I love that poem.
Yeah, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
Do you know that image of Pashupati?
No, I don't.
Oh, that's really...
That poem really resonated with me.
It's a beautiful, tiny image. I mean, it may be the original shaman image. It may be the original image of Shiva as Pashupati, lord of animals. It's a yogi sitting in meditation, and he's got antlers.
I love that. Did you consciously feel like you're trying to take people to places when you're writing this? I mean, I felt like you were trying to take yourself and us back to some kind of beginning.
Yes, indeed.
But we had to travel far in a short while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the occasion of the poem was I actually was listening to the radio news about how bad things were in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking, but wait a minute, that's where the Indus Valley civilization was, you know, and I know that image from, you know, more than 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with people not understanding or knowing anything about history, you know? It becomes a kind of an infection that we spread.
And again, that's one of the poet's jobs, is to connect people up with the lore, right? Not only with historical data, but also with mythology, universal images, archetypes, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Do you and Mary, your wife, who is also a poet, do you guys share poems with each other?
We do, but only at a very particular stage of the writing. You know,
when it's almost complete?
Yes. And then we're each other's best critic, I think. And so we know how to be very incisive with each other's work without hurting.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I often wonder if people who are in the same profession are competing in some way.
Well, I hope not. But, but you know, I always wanted to impress my wife with my poetry.
I'm sure it's worked. We're almost out of time, Peter. Can you tell us about anything you might be working on, new book, new poems, new performance?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, one of the wonderful things about having this book come out this year is that it really has given me new life as a poet, and it's helped me to feel reconnected with audiences again. So I've written a lot in 2013. I had a wonderful residency for the month of April down in Key West, and I wrote a whole suite of poems while I was in Key West, or I started them there anyway, and completed them during 2013.
So we're going to see another book?
I hope so, before long, yeah.
Uh-huh. And do you have any contact information, website or anything people can get in touch?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is if you're on Facebook. In fact, I have a public page, Peter Fortunato Poets, all one word. Anybody can access that. Or if you're on Facebook, you can send me a friend request or message me. I'm also in the telephone book if you're trying to get a hold of me. No website right now.
Okay, well, Peter Fortunato, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Late Morning, New and Selected Poems. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.